As she started for the door, it was pushed open, and a man in an RAF uniform came in.
"I'm here to collect," he began.
He looked at Mavis, then at Ben.
"Good God, Ben," Jeremy said. "What on earth are you doing here?"
When Ben recovered from his shock, he realized that he should not be surprised to see Jeremy. After all, he had told Ben that he would be working at the Air Ministry until he was fit to fly again.
"Hello, Jeremy," he said.
"But what are you doing here?"
Jeremy asked.
"You don't work for the Air Ministry, do you?"
"No, but I was sent to pick up a photograph here for one of the bosses."
"Amazing coincidence," Jeremy said.
He turned to Mavis.
"This chap and I were best friends growing up, and to meet him here of all places."
"Oh, then you can tell me all the secrets of his past," Mavis said. Jeremy raised an eyebrow.
"Oh, I get it. You and she... you sly dog." "We've only just met," Ben said, "but I did ask her out to the pictures."
"Tell you what," Jeremy said.
"Why don't you bring her to my party on Wednesday?"
He turned to Mavis.
"I've just moved into my parents' flat in Mayfair, and I'm going to celebrate my freedom with a flat-warming party."
"Mayfair? How grand!"
Mavis's eyes sparkled.
"Oh, Ben, I'd love that."
"Can you get time off?"
"You bally well know I'm going to work it somehow, even if I have to take awful shifts for a month."
"Then let me write down the address for you," Jeremy said. "We'll have fun. The old man has a good cellar, and I plan to work my way through it."
"Spiffing," Mavis said. "I'm glad you have such interesting friends, Ben."
"Interesting?" Jeremy gave a mock frown. "How about handsome, dashing, debonair?"
"Those two," she said.
"Are the Sutton girls coming?"
Ben asked, trying to sound casual.
"Just Dido and Pama. Livy is too old and stodgy, and Phoebes is too young. It was quite a job persuading Lord Westerham to let Dido come up to town. They keep her on such a tight leash."
"Probably with a good reason," Ben said, and Jeremy grinned.
"There are going to be titled people there?" Mavis asked, her eyes wide now.
"Crikey! You're not a lord or something, are you?"
She turned to Ben.
"Just plain mister," Ben said.
"Jeremy's father is a sir."
"But I'm also just plain flight lieutenant," Jeremy said. "And I haven't even told you my name yet. Jeremy Prescott. And yours is?"
"Mavis," she stammered a little. "Mavis Pugh."
"There you are, Jeremy. You've bowled the poor girl off her feet," Ben said.
"So, if you're a flight lieutenant, why aren't you flying?" she asked, sounding bolder now.
"I escaped from a stalag in Germany recently and managed to make my way back home. I was shot and in rather bad shape. I'm still supposed to be recovering, but I didn't want to sit at home doing nothing, so they're letting me work at the ministry."
"I thought your face was familiar," she said, her eyes glowing now. "I saw your picture in the papers. The girls here were talking about your escape."
She looked at Ben.
"Were you also a flyer once?"
"He was in a plane crash caused by my bad piloting,"
Jeremy said quickly.
"I feel guilty about it every day of my life."
He paused, then added,
"And the offer still stands to get you a job at the Air Ministry, old chap. You'd have legitimate cause to visit Mavis often." "As tempting as that sounds, I don't think you'll find it's that easy to switch around in wartime," Ben said. "And I am playing my part where I'm working right now." "Well, I'd best be getting back to town," Jeremy said. "I'll see you two at my party, then."
He picked up the package, gave Mavis a wink, and strode out of the room. Chapter 32 Bletchley Park. Pamela and Froggy Braithwaite were back at the big house, studying transcripts.
It's interesting that they don't always use the same pieces of music, don't you think? Froggy said. I mean, they always sign on with Beethoven, but then they have a selection of German composers between news and commentaries. Probably only reminding the world how superior German culture is, Pamela said. But I think we should identify and study each of the pieces chosen. Maybe the notes spell something out. Maybe it's the fourth movement of the third symphony or something, and those numbers signify dates. I think you're chasing at straws, Pamela said. If they want to send messages to German sympathizers or agents in Britain, they would have to be brilliant to work out things like that. Unless they have code books. Maybe Bach means one thing, Handel another. But we don't have their code books, Pamela said. I wonder if MI5 knows more about this. We're shut out here, sworn to secrecy, and we have no idea what other ministries or departments know or don't know. I think we should ask Commander Travis about this. Maybe, Froggy said doubtfully. When Pamela went back to her room that night, she opened a drawer to put away the items she had taken with her while camping out, and she paused, frowning. Someone had been through her things. She distinctly remembered leaving her one good pair of nylon stockings wrapped in a handkerchief so that there was no chance they would catch on something and get a run in them. And her diary, she was sure that had been under her spare nightdress. Trixie arrived while Pamela was sitting on her bed considering this. "Oh, you're back in the land of the living," she said. "Are you finished with night shifts?" "For the moment, I think," Pamela said. "I say, Trixie, you didn't borrow my stockings, did you? I wouldn't be angry if you did, but it's just that they aren't where I put them." "I jolly well did not," Trixie said. "You know me better than that, Pamma. If I want to borrow something of yours, I ask." "Then someone has been snooping in my drawer," Pamma said. "Mrs. Entwistle, obviously," Trixie said. "I always thought she looked like the type who was a snoop. I don't know what she hoped to find, unless she gets a thrill from reading other people's diaries," Pamma said. "Why, is your diary full of juicy details?" Trixie grinned. "Absolutely not. It's about as boring as you can get. Yesterday we had cottage pie, and it was raining. That kind of thing. I never was the type to spill my innermost thoughts on paper." "Neither was I," Trixie said. "Too many prying eyes in my house when I was growing up. With two younger sisters, one had to be very careful." "The same with me," Pamela said. "Well, I don't suppose it mattered that Mrs. Entwistle looked through my things. I have nothing worth stealing. But it does feel a little creepy, doesn't it?" "Maybe we could set a trap for her and catch her out," Trixie suggested. "You know, a letter in German, or a photo of Adolf Hitler with the message, 'Meet me at midnight, mein Liebling.'" Pamela laughed. "You are awful, Trixie." "Well, she's a horrid cow. She steals our ration coupons and keeps the good food for herself. She deserves what she gets." Next morning, Pamela and Froggy discussed whether it made sense to repeat their actual listening out at the wireless receiving station. Neither wanted to admit defeat. "We could take it in turns," Froggy said. "I could go out there for one day, and then you could. I don't see any reason to stay overnight. I think I could bicycle 6 miles, and you could get one of the RAF guards to run you over there and back." "I suppose so," Pamela agreed. "Anything's worth a try at this stage, isn't it?" After Froggy had gone, she paced around the table, staring down at the transcripts and their notes. Music. And now messages home from our boys in Germany. Names. Addresses. Should she try to check that these were real prisoners of war with real addresses? She went to ask Commander Travis how they could look into this. "That would be a job for MI5, he said. "I'll get on the telephone to them and have them send someone over. Worth following up on, I agree."
Pamela went back to work, and that afternoon was informed that someone from MI5 was on his way up. Pamela smoothed back her hair and hastily applied some lipstick. There were rumours about the dashing chaps in the Secret Service. She knew that MI5 dealt with counter-espionage while MI6 sent out the spies abroad, but all the same, it must be dangerous dabbling in the grey world of spying. There was a tap on her door. In what she hoped was an efficient voice, she called,
"Come in!"
The door opened, and the last person she expected to see came into the room. She said,
"Ben?"
at the same time as he said, "Pamma?" Then they both laughed and said,
"I had no idea,"
at the same time.
"You're really working for MI5? She asked.
"I'm not allowed to tell you that, but since I'm here, I suppose you can deduce that the answer is yes," he said. "And you are not allowed to tell anybody. You do know that, especially not anybody at home."
"Of course. And you're not to tell anybody I'm working here at Bletchley."
"We've only heard whispers and rumours about what goes on at Bletchley," he said. "Station X, that's how the rest of the world knows you. But it's something to do with codes, isn't it? Are you really a code breaker?" She nodded. "Not a very good one, it would seem. We've been listening in on German propaganda broadcasts." "The new British broadcasting station, you mean?"
"Yes, that's it. My boss seems to think that there might be coded messages to fifth columnists within the broadcasts."
"Yes, we've considered that too," Ben said.
"You haven't come across a code book with a captured fifth columnist, have you?"
Ben smiled. "I don't think they make it as easy as that for us," Pamela sighed.
"Our problem is that we don't know where to start. If the coded messages are going to ordinary people, German sympathisers, then the codes would have to be quite simple, nothing like the clever stuff the Germans use to send messages to their aircraft and ships."
"You've been working on those, have you?" he asked.
"A little. Not the decoding as much as translating. But there are some brilliantly clever chaps here, and I probably shouldn't be talking about this, even to you."
"Are you working on this alone?" Ben asked.
"No, there are two of us, but my colleague is off, listening in at the wireless station today. At first, they sent us transcripts, and then I wondered whether we were missing anything by not hearing the actual spoken words, possible inflections, clearing of the throat, or even the music they use between news and commentary." Ben nodded.
"Interesting. And what have you found so far?"
"These are the latest transcripts and our notes," she said. "They always end their broadcasts with messages purporting to be sent from servicemen in German prison camps. You know, all jolly stuff about how well they are being treated. So I wondered if they were real people and addresses and not somehow in code."
Ben peered over her shoulder at the papers on the table. He was horribly aware of her presence, of the faint, fresh smell of her hair.
"You want us to check that the names, serial numbers, and addresses are genuine?"
"That's right. Should be simple enough." He read down the page. "What a lot of rubbish they talk. I wonder if anyone believes it."
"My boss says that people do. The news and commentaries play on their deepest fears, for the safety of their children and whether we are about to starve."
"And what's this music noted here?"
"That was another thought we had, that the piece of music was somehow significant. The chap I'm working with knows his music quite well. He's the one who identified the pieces we've mentioned. The only one that we could see might be important was the Royal Fireworks music."
"Golly, yes. Someone planning to blow up the king."
"Exactly. Have your lot heard any rumours like that?"
"Plenty of them. Nothing definite, but what words followed that particular piece?"
Pamela leafed through the transcripts. "Here," she said.
Our great German composer Handel wrote this for your English king, showing what a deep and abiding friendship there has been between our two countries, and what a rich heritage we create when we are not on opposite sides. Ben paused. Nothing obvious that one could read into that. No dates or places. Factual.
I know, Pamela agreed. We've been over it again and again, substituting letters, selecting words. Nothing.
So apart from this, it's been mainly Beethoven and Bach. Ben's finger was scanning down the pages. Apart from a couple of snippets of Wagner, very loud and depressing, Pamela pointed them out.
My pal Froggy, who knows these things, says that they are from various operas, all part of the Ring cycle.
What did you say?
Ben's voice was unexpectedly loud and sharp.
The operas are all part of the Ring cycle.
My God, that's it, Ben said.
Look, Pamma, I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to tell you, but we've been zeroing in on a secret group of fifth columnists working actively with Germany. They are mainly aristocrats, and they call themselves the Ring.
Crikey, Pamela said. So this is their signature piece. They are saying, take note of what comes after this.
It would seem so. Ben's finger was shaking as it ran down the page. Sergeant Jim Winchester, serial number 248403. To Mrs. Joan Winchester, 1 Milton Court, Sheffield.
That must be it, Pamma.
What's the betting? This is a message for their operative in Winchester, or a meeting in Winchester, and those numbers are a date, or a telephone, or a street number.
Pamela's eyes were shining.
Oh, yes! Brilliant!
I should copy them all down and take them back with me. Some of the names and addresses will be genuine to put us off the scent,
but everyone that follows the Wagner will contain information. Someone higher up than me will be able to figure out what and whom they might refer to.
Have the Wagner passages become more frequent lately?
We've only been listening recently, rather than reading transcripts, so they could have been going on for some time.
And do you happen to know if the number 1461 has shown up anywhere?
Not that I can remember, she frowned. It could have been in the middle of a longer serial number.
Don't worry, I can check, Ben said.
Take a seat. She went across to a desk and brought out a pad and fountain pen.
I'll help you copy them.
They sat side by side in companionable silence.
Are you going to Jeremy's party?
She asked at last.
Yes, I said I'd go.
Should be fun.
I hope so. I'm bringing a girl.
A girl?
She looked up abruptly.
Ben nodded.
I'm not sure that that was wise, but Jeremy sort of invited her himself, and she was so keen that I couldn't back out.
Is she nice?
I hardly know her. She may turn out to be a little too enthusiastic for me.
Pamela laughed.
Meaning that she's too keen on the physical contact?
Ben blushed.
I actually mean that she may gush. She's terribly impressed that some of the guests come from titled families, and she was obviously impressed by Jeremy.
Well, who wouldn't be?
Pamela laughed. Then she grew quiet again.
Do you find him changed, Ben, since he came back?
I've hardly spoken to him enough to know, but he seems, how shall I put it, harder, more seasoned. I wonder if the fun has gone.
Pamela nodded.
I suppose he's grown up a lot, gone from boy to man in the time he was away, and all the horrid things he went through in that prison camp, and then to escape. It's no wonder he's not as fun-loving as he once was.
They finished copying the names and addresses that followed the Wagner interludes. Ben stood up.
I should be getting back, he said. I want to be home before it's dark.
It's not easy getting around in London once the blackout takes effect.
The very least I can do is treat you to an early dinner in the dining hall, Pamela replied. The food isn't bad, in contrast to my landlady's cooking. Trixie and I think that she's the enemy's secret weapon, put here to poison Britain. They laughed as they went down the stairs. Outside, the sun was shining on the lake. People were sitting on the grass, others strolling under the trees. From the meadow beyond came the shouts of a game being played. Ben shook his head in amazement. "This place is unreal," he said. "You certainly landed on your feet being sent here, didn't you? It's like a country club. Actually, we all work so jolly hard that we make the most of time off," Pamela said. "Until recently, I was on a 12-hour night shift, and most of us work in those huts that are draughty and freezing in winter, and the pressure is enormous, knowing that if you don't break a code, men on a ship are going to die. People crack all the time and get sent away for rest cures." "That wasn't why you came home a couple of weeks ago, was it?" He looked at her with concern. Pamela didn't want to admit to him that she had fainted. "I had some leave owing to me, and when I heard that Jeremy had come back safely..." "Of course." Ben cleared his throat.
"Hey, Pamma, wait for me!"
A voice shouted behind them, and Trixie came running across the gravel forecourt.
"Are you going to the dining room?"
"Yes, we were."
"Me too. I've decided I can't face another of Mrs. Entwistle's suet puddings."
She looked up at Ben.
"Hello? Are you a new arrival?"
"No, he's from another department in London," Pamela said quickly. "He just came to drop off some papers and we bumped into each other. We're old friends from home."
"How jolly," Trixie said.
She held out her hand to Ben.
"Hello, I'm Trixie, Pamela's roommate."
"I'm Ben. Good to meet you." She squeezed his hand, an inquisitive smile on her face.
"Do you work at another hush-hush establishment?" she asked.
Ben chuckled. "I couldn't tell you if I did, could I?"
"It's just that they don't let just anybody come here, for any reason. So someone must have had a jolly good reason for sending you here."
Trixie turned to Pamela.
"I shall worm it out of you when we get home," she said. "Or I shall make a date with Ben and worm it out of him. You're not going to Jeremy Prescott's party by any chance, are you?"
"As a matter of fact, I am," Ben said.
"And he's taking a girl, Trixie, so hands off."
"Spoilsport,"
Trixie gave a mock pout.
"I might turn on the full force of my feminine charms and lure him away from her."
She gave Ben a flirtatious smile.
"Come on, before there's a line at the cafeteria. I hear there might be cauliflower cheese tonight."
She took Ben's hand again and dragged him forward. On the train back to London, Ben sat staring at the names and addresses he had copied out. Some of the names were definitely also places. Some could be places. Mrs. North at 4 Hampton Street could well mean Northampton. Max Knight should be able to find out if they coincided with known meetings of the ring. But did any of this have relevance to the photograph? If it was so important that a man's life had been risked to deliver it, then surely the message could not have been for general consumption, but for one person's ears only. And they were no closer to finding out who that person was. He tried to quell the sense of urgency he felt. The Royal Fireworks music and the date 1461, when battles were fought to depose a king, made him believe that a plot to kill the royal family might well be imminent. But he reminded himself that he was on the lowest rung. If he was not given the full information, how could he be expected to interpret it properly? Still, he knew that the king and queen often walked through bombed areas of London, showing sympathy and support. How easy for a lone gunman waiting for them in the shadows. He shivered and stared out the train window. His thoughts turned to Mavis. If she could only find the sight in the snapshot, then all would be explained. He tried to picture it now,
the hill with the pine trees, but couldn't imagine any relevance unless there was a stately home on the hill behind those trees where an aristocrat lived who was an important part of the ring, or that this might be a place the royal family had planned to visit. Then he found himself thinking not of his assignment, but of Mavis herself. She was an attractive girl, vivacious, fun. But did he really fancy her? Was it just that she was nothing like Pamela, and he needed to take his mind off the girl he couldn't have? His thoughts drifted to her now, how soft and serene and elegant she always looked, how her eyes sparkled when she smiled, how her hair smelled somehow like fresh gardens. "Stop it," he commanded himself. "Think of something else." Pamela's friend Trixie. She had seemed interested in him, which she found amazing, because clearly she was the kind of Debbie girl who would go more for the Jeremy Prescotts of this world. The party might prove interesting after all. Chapter 33 Mayfair, Jeremy's Flat.
"You're looking remarkably couth tonight," Guy Harcourt said as he stopped by Ben's room. "Don't tell me you're going somewhere civilized."
"A party in Mayfair, actually," Ben said.
"Good God! Are there still such things?"
"It's been given by a friend who has taken over his father's flat," Ben said.
"Anyone I know?"
"Jeremy Prescott? I think you do know him. He was up at Oxford at the same time as us." Guy nodded.
"Of course I know him. We used to cruise around together on the Deb circuit, and then Oxford, of course. Although he was a Balliol man, wasn't he? Do you think he'd mind if I tag along? I am actually in the Slough of Despond and in desperate need of cheering up."
"I don't see why not," Ben said.
"He seemed to be asking all and sundry." "Wizard! I'll go and change."
"I'd better give you the address," Ben said. "I have to pick up a girl at the station."
"You're bringing a date, you sly dog."
"You don't know everything about me," Ben said with a grin. "However, I'm not sure how much of a date she is.
But she's a warm body. That's all that counts in wartime," Guy said. "God, I'm feeling positively sex-starved, aren't you? And all this having to keep silent about what we're doing. It really cramps one's style. The girls who would be impressed by my chasing German spies now think that I'm a physical wreck who is a filing clerk."
Ben nodded in agreement. "It definitely is trying. But cheer up. You can down your troubles in Sir William Prescott's good wine." He left Guy putting on evening clothes and made his way to the station. Mavis was waiting for him. She smiled when she saw him, but there was a flicker of nervousness, too.
"Cripes! I didn't realize it was to be a formal affair," she said. "I'm dressed for an ordinary party."
"I'm sure you look just fine," Ben said. "And I'm also sure there will be some people there not wearing formal dress. I put this on just in case, and because I don't have a decent-looking suit any more. Mine was made before the war, and I've filled out since then."
"I think you look just right," she said, and slipped her hand through his arm.
She was wearing a little too much perfume, and her dress was a little too frilly, but her eyes sparkled, and he liked the feel of her closeness.
"You didn't have any problem getting away, then?" he asked. She made a face. "My mother wasn't at all keen on my going up to London alone, but I told her I was going with a group of friends from work, and we were going dancing."
"What time do you have to be back?" Ben asked.
"I told her I might spend the night at Cynthia's house," she said, giving him a knowing look. "I'm not sure that she believed me, but Cynthia's family doesn't have a telephone, and I know my mum is not about to walk 2 miles to check on us."
They caught the bus down to Marble Arch. Ben wondered if he should have splurged for a taxi, but reasoned that there were precious few to be found these days, and all sorts of people took public transportation. From Marble Arch, they walked down Park Lane. It was almost 9 o'clock at night, but not dark yet, and people were still out and about, enjoying the fine weather. Several men in uniform were going into Grosvenor House, and Ben heard the faint strains of a dance band. So there were elegant evenings still for those who could afford it. An ARP warden, one of the volunteers who handled air raid precautions, was standing watch on the corner of Curzon Street, ready to pounce on blackout violators.
"Off somewhere nice, then?"
he asked as they passed him.
"We're going to a party," Mavis said.
"Make sure you keep the noise down, and don't let any light show," he said. "Your lot in this area think you can disregard all the rules just because you have money."
"Pleasant sort of chap," Ben whispered as they walked away. Mavis laughed and slipped her hand into his. Her hand felt warm and comforting. He looked at her and they exchanged a smile. Jeremy's flat was not in a large block, but occupied an entire floor of an older Georgian house. A small lift had been installed beside the staircase, and they rode this to the third floor. Ben was conscious of Mavis's presence and suspected that she was deliberately pressing herself against him. As the lift doors opened, the wailing of Benny Goodman's clarinet came to greet them. The front door to the flat was half open, and music and cigarette smoke wafted out to them as they entered a foyer. Beyond it was a large and well-appointed drawing room. The blackout curtains hadn't yet been drawn, and the room was still lit by the last of the twilight. It was hard to make out the colours of the upholstery, or to identify the old masters on the white walls tinged with a rosy hue. There were a dozen or more people inside. Two couples were dancing, but Ben didn't recognise either pair. Jeremy was playing bartender. He looked up and waved a cocktail glass as he saw them.
"Come on in," he called. "I'm just about to open a 20-year-old Chateauneuf du Pape."
"Won't your father kill you when he finds out?" Ben asked as they approached the bar.
"Doing him a favour, old man. What if we get a direct hit and all that lovely wine flowed into the gutter? At least we'll be enjoying it, and knowing my father, he'll find out where to acquire more once the war is over." "Only it may be Hock and Mosel," someone standing near joked.
"Oh, gosh, you don't really believe the Germans will invade, do you?"
Mavis turned frightened eyes on them.
"It's a possibility we have to face," the young man who had made the joke replied. "They had little trouble invading every other country in Europe. There are only 20 miles of channel separating us." "Let's not talk about gloomy things tonight," Jeremy said. "I'm home. I'm in a cozy flat with my friends around me, and we're damned well going to enjoy ourselves. Wine or cocktails? Help yourselves."
Then he looked up as Guy came into the room.
"Good God, it's Harcourt. How did he get here?"
"I invited him," Ben said. "He shares digs with me. I hope that was all right."
"Of course," Jeremy said. "The more the merrier."
But Ben could tell that he wasn't pleased. Guy came over to shake hands.
"Long time no see, Prescott," he said. "Absolutely. What are you doing with yourself, Harcourt?" "Pen-pushing, I'm afraid. I failed the medical. I know I look a strapping specimen, but apparently I have a weak heart." "That's too bad," Jeremy said. "Well, drink up. They say red wine is fortifying, don't they? Now I must take a glass of wine to my favourite woman."
Ben had been surreptitiously scanning the room, looking for Pamela. Then he saw her standing in the doorway and looking a little shy, which was unusual for her. Then he noticed she wasn't alone. Trixie came in with her, dressed in a black sheath dress with an emerald green opera cape over it.
"Hello, Ben,"
she said, deliberately pushing past Pamela to give him a kiss on the cheek.
"I must say you look stunning," he replied.
"Why, thank you for the compliment, kind sir," she replied. "Now where is our host?"
"Pouring drinks," Pamela replied. Then Ben noticed that Dido stood behind her, wearing more makeup than her father would have approved of, and a slinky red Chinese-style dress, which made her look older than her 18 years. Her face broke into a big smile when she saw Ben.
"Hello, Ben," she called. "I didn't know you were going to be here. How super. Won't it be fun?"
"However did you get your father to agree to this?" Ben asked.
"Pamela swore to watch me like a hawk and put me on the milk train home in the morning. But as you can imagine, I had to beg, plead, whine and pout before he said yes. I wish I had known that you'd be coming, because he would have been happier knowing that you'd keep an eye on me. He thinks you are a wonderfully steadying influence."
"Gosh, what a responsibility," Ben said. Then he remembered Mavis standing at his side. "Dido, this is Mavis. Mavis, this is..." He hesitated and might have been about to say Lady Diana Sutton, but Dido cut him off.
"Hello, I'm Dido," she said. "Golly, we didn't know Ben had a girlfriend. You are so secretive and naughty, Benjamin."
"We only met recently." Ben gave an embarrassed smile.
"Do you work together?"
Dido asked. "No, not usually. We met when I had to deliver some papers to the place where Mavis works." Dido turned to Mavis.
"They wouldn't have a job for me where you work, would they? I am desperate to do something useful."
"It's in Buckinghamshire, Dido," Ben said. "You know your father wouldn't let you live away from home."
"Pamela does. Mavis does," Dido said.
Mavis chuckled.
"No, I don't. I live with my mother, worse luck. I had to tell some enormous fibs to come out with Ben tonight." "Well done, you," Dido said. "A girl after my own heart."
Jeremy handed Pamela and Dido glasses of wine. Then he saw Trixie.
"Hello, another familiar face from the past," he said.
"I'm flattered that you remember me," Trixie replied.
"How could I forget? You were a brilliant dancer. I say, your season was a lot of fun, wasn't it? And as it happens, the last for a while."
"Don't remind me," Dido said. "Have pity on poor girls like me who will never come out now."
"You look as if you're doing quite well without coming out, young Dido," Jeremy said. "Drink up. There's plenty more. And food through in the dining room. Sorry that the eats won't be up to the same standard as the drinks," he added. "I had cook make a mousse from a couple of tins of salmon, and we smoked a trout from the lake, and I've some early strawberries from the garden, so we'll have to make do with those."
"Make do with those?" Mavis whispered to Ben. "Where did he manage to get his hands on tins of salmon?"
"Better not ask," Ben whispered back. She gave him a conspiratorial smile.
"Come and dance with me," she said. "I like this song."
"I have to warn you, I'm a mediocre dancer," Ben replied.
"No, you're not. You're a good dancer. Don't be so modest," Pamela said.
As Ben led Mavis toward the parquet floor where others were dancing, Pamela muttered to him,
"She's nice. I fully approve."
It was a slow foxtrot. Mavis demonstrated that she was quite willing to rest her cheek against his. But it wasn't even quite dark outside, and Ben felt it was a little early in the evening for such things.
"So are those the two girls from the titled family?" she asked him. Ben nodded.
"They seem awfully nice. Not snooty at all."
"They are nice. I've known them all my life. We grew up together."
"And what about the sexy girl in black? She seemed rather keen on you."
"I expect she flirts with anything in trousers," Ben said. "She works with Pamela at another government department out in the country."
"I can see I have some stiff competition for you," Mavis said.
She looked around.
"You have such glamorous friends. Your friend Jeremy is so handsome. He and Pamela make a lovely couple, don't they?"
Ben glanced up to see that Jeremy was now dancing with Pamela. He had no such reserve as Ben. His arms were wrapped tightly around her, and they moved as one across the floor. Her head was on his shoulder. Her eyes were closed. She looked perfectly content. Ben tightened his grip on Mavis, and she responded, moving closer to him. At around 11 o'clock, the air raid sirens went off.
Should we go down to a basement or an air raid shelter or something? One of the girls asked nervously.
You don't think they dare to bomb Mayfair, do you?
A man replied, making everyone laugh.
I know, Jeremy shouted. Let's go up onto the roof. We'll have a great view from there. Wait while I open the champagne first. It's Veuve Clicquot, the old man's favourite.
There was a loud pop. Champagne welled over the top of the bottle, and glasses were held out to be filled.
Come on, this way, Jeremy called.
And as if he were the Pied Piper, they followed him through to the kitchen.
It's a bit tricky, but we'll manage, he shouted back over the drone of approaching aircraft. I used to do it all the time.
He pushed up the window, climbed out onto a narrow parapet. Others followed. Ben went first, then helped Mavis, who proved to be agile and fearless. Along the parapet they went, and then up a short ladder to a flat roof above. Once there, they laughed at their own bravado and clinked champagne glasses. Jeremy went down and reappeared with the gramophone and, in the mood, blasted out. Some revellers started dancing. Around them, London lay in darkness, but above, searchlights strafed the sky, making barrage balloons suddenly sparkle as they were caught in the beam. Big Ben was highlighted, and then disappeared again. And then the shape of approaching aircraft flying in formation. To the south came the staccato sound of AK-AK guns, punctuated with the deeper boom as a bomb was dropped. The bombs must have been incendiaries, because fires had now broken out across the river. A girl jumped up on the parapet that ran around the rim of the roof.
"We're not afraid of you, Mr. Hitler! Do your worst!" she shouted, waving her champagne glass at the sky.
A bomb fell nearer now, then another, shattering the calm of the night with deep booms that could almost be felt rather than heard. Then they heard explosions close by, and fire rose beyond the blackness of trees.
"What is that big building?"
the girl on the parapet said.
"They've hit the palace!"
someone shouted.
"Oh, God! They've hit the palace!"
Ben felt his heart jerk. Was this the promised attack, the one they had been warned of? The royal fireworks music? The deposing of a king? The palace is huge, he told himself. The royal family would be safely in the basement. They might have damaged a few rooms, but they couldn't make the whole place burn down. The first wave of aircraft was now overhead. Responding gunfire sent bright traces into the night, coming from close by in Hyde Park. Another bomb, closer now.
"That was around St. James's," one of the men said. "Getting too close for comfort."
"Don't be such a ninny,"
a girl behind Ben replied. It sounded like Trixie.
"We're not going down. We're not going to show them that we're scared. We need Jeremy to bring us some more champagne. Where is he?"
Ben looked around and didn't see him. Then Pamela tugged at his sleeve.
"Where is Dido? I can't see her," she whispered.
"Perhaps she was afraid and went back down," he said. Pamela shook her head.
"When have you ever known Dido to be afraid?"
"I'll come and help you look for her," Ben said. "Don't worry. She's probably only gone to the loo." He turned to Mavis. "Be right back." Then he helped Pamela down the ladder and along the parapet. Not that she needed help. She walked with that same confidence he remembered from their tree-climbing days. He was just assisting her to climb in through the window when there was a whistling sound, a flash, a boom, and a blast that almost knocked him over. A building across the street burst into flames. Glass and debris came flying at them. He shoved Pamela inside, shielding her.
"Were we hit?" she asked, her voice shaking.
"No, across the street." They could hear shouting from the roof and a man's voice saying,
"Get down from here now! This is madness!"
As they emerged from the kitchen, a door at the end of the hall opened and Dido came flying out. She was wearing only her slip and her hair was in disarray.
"Have we been bombed?" she asked.
The windows just blew in. Oh, my God, there is glass everywhere.
It's all right. It's across the street. Jeremy came to join her. He was holding a towel around his waist.
Pamela looked at them, then said in a clipped voice,
Dido, get dressed now. I'm taking you home.
She looked at Ben.
Do you think there will be a train at this time of night?
You might catch the last train if you hurry, he said. If you miss it, you can come back to my place. I'll go and find a taxi.
Other people were now climbing in through the kitchen window, laughing a little too loudly, as those who have escaped danger often do.
More champagne, a male voice commanded. Bartender, give us your best.
Jeremy had also gone back into the dark room, but emerged again, having hastily put on a shirt and trousers, but no jacket and tie.
Of course, drinks all around, he said with forced gaiety.
As he passed Pamela, he touched her sleeve.
Pamma, I can explain.
She shook him loose.
Don't touch me, she said coldly.
Can we go now, please, Ben? Then she remembered.
I must just tell Trixie that I have to go, and I'll see her tomorrow. Someone will take her to the station.
At that moment, Ben remembered Mavis. He pushed through the stream of guests to her.
Look, something has come up, and I have to take somebody home now, he said. I'm frightfully sorry. Can I drop you at the station, or would you rather stay on?
She looked confused.
I don't know. Is the party over? There's no train at this time of night.
You could come back to my place, but...
Her gaze went to Pamela standing rock still behind him.
I get the picture. I expect I'll be all right. I'm a big girl.
No, it's not like that, he said.
I promise you, and I'm really sorry, it's just that...
He couldn't finish the sentence. Guy appeared at his side.
A spot of bother? He asked.
Actually, yes. Could you look after Mavis and make sure she gets to the station safely?
Of course, Guy said.
But what are you doing?
Pamela and Diana Sutton need to leave now. Diana's not feeling well. I'll tell you later.
All right, old chap. Don't worry about it. I'll be a perfect Boy Scout.
Guy gave him a grin. Dido emerged from the bedroom fully clothed. Her lipstick was smudged and her hair still looked unkempt.
Into the lift, now, Pamela commanded.
Dido looked at her sister defiantly.
You wouldn't give him what he wanted, so I did, she said, then stalked past Pamela with her head held high.
Ben heard Jeremy shouting from inside the room.
Nobody needs to leave. A couple of broken windows are not going to spoil our party. Besides, we don't want to get in the way of fire engines and ARP workers. So let's keep going and have eggs and bacon at dawn, as I promised. I have real bacon, people. Think of that.
The lift doors closed, and they went down in silence. Chapter 34 London. Ben found a taxi outside the Dorchester, and they sped to Victoria Station. Beyond the darkness of the parks, fires were burning.
They got Buckingham Palace again, the buggers, the cabbie said. Blimey, I hope we pay them back, make them suffer for this. I wouldn't spare a single man, woman or child if I were Mr. Churchill.
Is the damage bad? Ben asked.
I ain't seen it myself, the cabbie replied. They've got the road blocked off, ain't they? But you could certainly see the flames.
They passed Hyde Park Corner and headed down Grosvenor Place. Dido stared out the window, not saying a word.
Will you both go back to Kent now? Ben asked.
I have to be at work in the morning, Pamela said.
I think there are trains on the main line all night. Besides, I couldn't trust myself not to hurl her out of the train.
So how will someone know to come and meet her at the station?
Ben asked. I'll telephone from Victoria. I'll tell them there was a bomb and we had to leave in a hurry. Nothing more needs to be said.
You don't need to talk about me in the third person, Dido said. I'm a person. I have feelings too, you know.
You don't deserve feelings, Pamela said. You have no idea what feelings are.
You always wanted what was mine, all the while we were growing up, and you took it too.
They reached the station and ran toward the platforms.
11:55. We should have time to get it, Ben said.
There won't be a local at this time of night, Pamela said, gasping a little as they ran.
I'll tell Pa to come and pick you up in Sevenoaks.
All right. Dido suddenly sounded very young and insecure.
Do you want me to take her home? Ben asked.
I'm on fairly flexible hours at the moment, so it would be all right.
Pamela gave him a grateful look.
Would you really? That would be so kind. I don't like the thought of her alone on a train in the blackout.
You could both come back to my place if it would be easier.
It really wouldn't, Pamela said. I'm afraid I need to be alone and I can't be civilized much longer. And I want Dido far away.
Stop talking about me as if I was a piece of meat, Dido said.
Look, I'm sorry. It didn't mean anything. We were drinking and we were excited by the bombs and it just happened. And do you know what? It was jolly nice, and you're stupid to keep pushing him away.
That's enough, Dido, Pamela snapped.
She almost pushed her sister into the train.
Tell Mummy I'll see her on Friday as arranged, she said.
What's happening on Friday?
Mummy's having a little garden party this weekend, and she is in a panic because there's no proper food and not enough servants, so I said I'd come down and help.
Pamela looked at Ben appealingly.
If you're not working, you wouldn't like to come down too, would you?
I was planning on asking Jeremy to come and help serve drinks and things, but now...
Of course I'll come, Ben said.
Trixie said she'd come as well. She said she'd dress as a maid and serve things. Pamela smiled, the lines of worry vanishing from her face for a moment.
We both managed to wangle Friday afternoon and Saturday off, so we'll hope to catch a train about 4 if you want to join us.
I'll be there. He smiled at her as he climbed on board after Dido. A whistle sounded. Pamela reached up to him and covered his hand with hers.
I'm so glad you're here, Ben. I can always count on you.
The train pulled out of the station. Ben looked back and saw her small, slim figure standing there, watching them. The explanation of a bomb being dropped on the next-door building was readily accepted. Ben stopped at his father's house, where he spent the night. Then he caught an early train back to London. Guy opened his door as Ben came up the stairs.
"So where did you get to?"
he asked with a suggestive smile.
Was it 2 for the price of 1? I can see why you chose them over Miss Mavis. A lovely girl, but a bit too gushing for my taste. I deposited her at the station at 6, as requested.
Thank you so much. She must be furious with me.
Not too furious, I think. I gave her a bit of a kiss and a cuddle in the taxi, so I think she had a good time, and certainly plenty of tales to tell her workmates. How the toffs live and all that.
He stared at Ben.
You look washed up. You'd better come in and I'll make you coffee.
Ben needed no second invitation.
Thank God that coffee isn't rationed, Guy said. My one vice these days.
If you can find it, Ben added. He sank onto Guy's bed.
What a night, he said. So what was going on, really?
Guy asked as he filled a kettle. Pamela Sutton found her little sister in bed with Jeremy Prescott, Ben said. The kid is only 18 or 19.
18 isn't what it was before the war, Guy replied. People grow up quickly these days. They have to. And many people's philosophy is let's grab it while we can because we might not be here tomorrow.
And it's true, isn't it? If that bomb had fallen a few yards to the right, we'd all be toast by now.
Ben shivered. You're right.
So Diana was sent home in disgrace. I took her home, actually. Pamela had to get back to work, and she was too upset. So she was dating Prescott, was she?
Oh, yes, ever since they were children.
That's how the RAF behave. I live with danger, so I take what I want.
I rather think he's always behaved that way, Ben said. The kettle boiled, and Guy poured coffee. Then he said slowly,
"There's something you should probably know. Lady Margot Sutton."
"Yes, I heard. She was taken by the Gestapo in Paris. A rescue was being planned."
"And was carried out successfully," Guy said.
Ben's eyebrows went up.
"Really? She's home? That's wonderful." "Her family doesn't know she's home yet. I'm not sure when they'll be told. There is some debriefing to be carried out, but that's not what I wanted to tell you. I gather that Captain King has mentioned the secret society called the Ring to you."
"He has."
"So you know who they are and what they plan?"
Ben nodded.
"Aristocrats who want to aid Germany." "It seems that Margot Sutton showed up at a meeting the other evening."
"A meeting of the Ring?"
"That's right." "Did Captain King, as you refer to him, know she was going to be there?" "You know him. Keeps his cards really close to his chest, but I think this took him by surprise."
"So Margot Sutton will be watched?"
"Oh, yes, definitely. And when she is allowed home, I rather think that task will fall on you."
"Crikey," Ben said.
As soon as Ben went to his own room, he wrote a note to Mavis, explaining that one of the sisters had drunk too much and become ill, necessitating that she be rushed to Victoria Station to catch the last train. He hoped she would forgive him, and that Guy looked after her well, and he hoped their next date would be less dramatic. Then he took it to the postbox on the corner. With any luck, it would arrive by the last post that evening, or at the latest by tomorrow morning. He didn't want her to think that he had ditched her in favour of a more sophisticated girl. Meanwhile, Pamela woke alone in the room she shared with Trixie. She felt hollow and drained, as if she were recovering from a bout of stomach flu. She wondered now if Dido and Jeremy had been having sex during those afternoon visits at his house. Hardly probable with his mother and the servants in the house, but one could never tell with Jeremy. He loved to live dangerously. She'd always known that. Pamela stood up, stretched, then went over to the window to pull back the blackout curtain. It was a grey, gloomy day, matching her mood. It was over, she thought. How could she ever feel safe with a man who had betrayed her with her own sister? If they had married, would she picture the worst every time he was late getting home? Dido was a stupid and frustrated little girl. She saw that now, dying for those things that had been denied her, the balls and flirtations of a season, and now an active means of employment. No wonder she let Jeremy seduce her. Had they actually completed their lovemaking before the bomb hit? She wondered. Had Dido been a virgin before? If so, had it hurt? Her own insecurities came flooding over her while an express train rushed past her window with a wild shriek. She had just finished washing and brushing her teeth when Trixie came home.
"God, what a night!"
Trixie flung herself down on her bed.
"I drank far too much. We all did. My dear, I was so tired, I dozed off on the train. Luckily it tooted a whistle, or I might have woken up and found myself in crew."
She sat up and studied Pamela.
"Are you all right?"
she asked.
"I think so. I'll survive."
Trixie came over and sat beside her.
"Was it what I think it was? Jeremy in bed with your sister?"
Pamela nodded.
"I'm sorry. He would never have been right for you, you know.
He made a pass at me last night after you'd gone. And when I said that he was NSIT, not safe in taxis, I meant it. Back during that Deb season, he wouldn't take no for an answer, you know. And if the driver hadn't turned around and asked, "Are you all right, miss?" I'm sure he would have raped me. So you're probably better off without him. She stopped, looked at Pamela's face, then said, "What a stupid thing to say. You love him, don't you?"